Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Think, Dolly, think. There must be something really rotten we can do today.
I'm thinking. But the worst I come up with is helping to make Moose and Squirtle show 1 hour longer.
So what did they expect, Boris and Natasha from Rocky and Bullwinkle? I mean, things that Russian spies are not supposed to do, according to the media coverage of those arrested. They're not supposed to live normal suburban lives in Montclair, not supposed to live swinging singles lives in Manhattan, not supposed to write newspaper columns for El Diario, critical of the United States, or raise children who study classical piano, or work as financial planners in capitalist system. Oh, wait, Russia is capitalist, too. So the media line seems to be that everything the alleged spies ever did was something spies don't do. Let's talk about the Keystone Cops of espionage and whether perhaps there's more to this story than meets the eye. Scott Shane is national security correspondent covering it for the New York Times. Hi, Scott. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And your headline today is Spying Suspects Blended In But Seemed Short on Secrets. So it doesn't appear that for all the time and effort over a 10-year period that these Russian spies were able to gather much actual intelligence?
That seems to be the case. I mean, their instructions were not to try to get U.S. government jobs because they had these legends, as they call them in the spy business, these sort of backstories that couldn't really hold up to extensive scrutiny. One, as people probably have read, took the identity of a dead Canadian. And so, you know, presumably if the FBI did a decent background check on a government job with a clearance, they would have found that kind of thing. And so they were ordered instead to collect, you know, it certainly seems from the outside to be routine information that you could get from the web or, God forbid, from the newspaper.
And they were not charged with espionage because they were not caught sending any actual classified information back to Russia. So what did they send back that kept the Russians paying them for 10 years in some cases?
Well, you know, that's one of the curious things is the lack of espionage charges. The FBI had these guys wired for years. The first references in the criminal complaints go back to 2000, the year 2000, when some of them, at least, were already under intensive surveillance and their, you know, their calls and conversations were being recorded. So presumably the FBI would have picked it up if they'd actually gotten some classified information and sent it back to Russia. What they did send back, at least from the evidence in the detailed criminal complaints, which are available on the web and make for quite entertaining reading, was, you know, things like one of them was thanked by Moscow Center, as they call the intelligence headquarters, for sending a report on prospects for the global gold market. This was supposedly based on her talking to some contacts in New York. But, it's sort of like stock tips or something.
Yeah, which you can find on any Bloomberg terminal.
Yes, exactly. So you do wonder whether this kind of spying has sort of survived into an era when it's no longer relevant.
Well, one of my producers floated a theory in the office that the joke was really on Russia. These spies knew the spying program was a joke, and they were just milking Moscow for the income they were making. Is there any indication of that?
Well, there is. You know, anyone who's read the old Graham Greene novel called Our Man in Havana would know the pattern. That guy, the guy in the novel, was sending vacuum cleaner schematics back to his headquarters and claiming they were missile diagrams and getting paid. And there was this little flap that's reflected in the court papers over the house in Montclair, this couple who called themselves the Murphys, Richard and Cynthia Murphy, were buying a house in Montclair. You know, they're moving from Hoboken from a rental, and they were, you know, following the American dream. And there was a dispute over whether the house should be titled in their name. It was unclear to me from the paperwork, you know, how else it could be titled. You wouldn't really want to put it in the name of the SVR, the current name of the KGB.
Right.
But it was very funny. Their defense of themselves was that they were just trying to do as the Romans do, that this is a society that values home ownership, and that they, you know, they deserve to own a home, which is kind of hilarious, and did raise the question of whether they were, you know, completely had their eye on the ball of you know, espionage, or perhaps had been had been seduced by American bourgeois values.
I got a subprime mortgage and got foreclosed upon. I'm really an American now.
Exactly.
Another theory I've heard, though, is that this is just the way spying works. A big country like Russia floods the zone with spies, knowing most of them will not find anything, but with the odds being that a few will, because there are enough of them in the field. Could it have been about that?
Yes. I mean, Milt Bearden, who's a retired CIA guy who worked against the Soviet Union for years, we talked to yesterday, and he said, you know, these people were mostly, or partially at least, self-supporting. They had jobs for the most part. And so perhaps the costs weren't that high. And as he said, you know, maybe they get lucky. Maybe they, you know, happen to bump into someone who really has some serious industrial or technological or national security secrets. And you're sort of off to the races. More common among ex-spies who used to work against Russia was the notion that this was sort of archaic, that was being done by Russia as a sort of matter of pride, and this is what great countries do kind of thing. And, you know, Oleg Kalugin, who I talked to, who's a retired KGB general, who was under legal cover, diplomatic cover, working in out of Washington, out of New York, back in the old days, he was shocked. He said he didn't think that the Soviet Union had this many of illegals, as they're called, people working under non-official cover, under false names, even at the height of the Cold War. So he thought it was a little bit goofy.
Scott Shane, national security correspondent for the New York Times, with us talking about the alleged Russian spy ring arrests. We can take phone calls from anybody with a question about this unusual story, or maybe anyone who actually knew or knows one of those arrested, and you were surprised that somebody who seemed to be living a, quote, normal life near you was picked up. 212-433-WNYC. Call us up if you want, 212-433-9692, or post a question or a thought to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And also with us to discuss one of those arrested is Javier Castano, editor of the newspaper Queens Latino. He helped break the story of El Diario La Prensa columnist Vicky Paulet as one of those arrested. Hi, Javier. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
What was your role in reporting this story?
I received a call from a friend of mine Monday morning around 8:30 saying, do you know what happened with Vicky Paulet? And I said, no. Everybody's like asking because we have information about she being arrested in her house, and I said, I don't know anything. So I start calling a lot of people in Washington and here in New York, and finally a guy from the FBI told me, I cannot deny or confirm that your information, but I can say to you that the Department of Justice is going to say something about this case. So, Obviously, the guy just said to me, okay, this is going on.
You had a good tip, and you got her name out.
So I just put that in my website, and I start calling the Department of Justice, and I got all the information before everybody. I was a little bit ahead, like 2 hours ahead of everybody. Yeah.
And next thing you know, people like Scott Shane were putting it in the New York Times. Juan Gonzalez in the Daily News today writes about Paulet, that she's 55, very well known in Latin American journalism and U.S. Latino journalism. She was a TV news pioneer in Peru as a tough young reporter when she was younger, and a very respected opinion columnist here who tended to be very critical of the United States. All true?
Yes. I know Vicky Paulet for a long, long time, probably around 20 years. I have worked with her. She's very passionate about what she's writing. She's always writing about Cuba, about Castro, about Chavez, Evo Morales, and defending the Indians from South America. She's from Cusco and Machu Picchu, that area in the mountains of Peru. So, she's a strong woman. She's always saying whatever she wants to say and writing. She's always attacking the United States in her columns, yes.
In policy terms. And I wonder if you share the reaction of our friend Gerson Borrero from El Diario, who's been a longtime columnist there and now with his own Borrero Report. Here was his reaction on All Things Considered yesterday.
Shocked, surprised, incredulous. I just felt that there's got to be something wrong here. I thought it was a joke. There was a reaction. A part of me started at some point laughing. She's just like any other journalist. She happens to be writing in Spanish, but nothing out of the norm, nothing that would indicate to me that she was a part of this.
So, Javier, I get the sense that at first everybody at El Diario was very skeptical that she could actually be part of this, and maybe it was a mistake or a trumped-up charge even because she's critical of the U.S. and her policies. But now they've kind of clammed up. So maybe they're looking at the evidence and seeing that maybe there is something there?
The first reaction of people in El Diario and friends in the metropolitan area is like, okay, this can has to be wrong. She's not that kind of person. But then after you read the indictment, the 37 pages in which they claimed that they tape recorded her saying, why are we in this mess and how the government of that country doesn't believe in what we are doing. And they also claimed that she borrowed from South America $80,000, and they have all this evidence, right? But as many people are saying, they have to show everybody what kind of information they handle. They had to deliver to the government of Russia, and that is not clear.
Yes, and of course everybody in this case, as in all cases, is innocent until proven guilty. This is just an indictment. Betty in Yonkers is calling in. One of Vicky Pelez's neighbors, Betty?
Yes, I am. I live four homes down from Vicky. Her husband, I didn't know Vicky, but her husband has been in my store. I have a little carrot shop on Broadway. Uh-huh. And her husband has been in many times to introduce himself as my neighbor. And I tell you that I was on my lawn Sunday night when just a slew of, I didn't know at the time, were FBI agents. They were all in, you know, tinted windows and parked in front of my home. And I thought there was a party going on. It was early Monday morning when I went by and I saw just a slew of computers and files all cataloged on the lawn. And I thought there was something more than just, you know, a party that happened the night before.
So this is the buzz of the block in Yonkers today, right?
That's exactly right.
Thank you very much. Carol in Manhattan has a theory about why these busts took place now. Hi, Carol.
Hello. I wouldn't call it a theory so much as a supposition. It occurred to me that this is all very superficial, and it seems somewhat naive in that I thought it had a much more diplomatic take to it, meaning that there's some sort of negotiations that are going on. This is a way to embarrass Russia in this public way, and embarrass them why, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the U.S. is trying to put pressure on them, you know, in terms of dealing with China or dealing with Korea, mm-hmm. North Korea, that is. And this, I mean, for this to come out now after so many years of knowing these people are here, and it almost seems harmless what they were unable to do.
Carol, interesting. And let me put that to New York Times national security correspondent Scott Shane. Scott, what do you think about that theory?
Well, you know, it's certainly a theory that's worthy of consideration, and there was some unhappiness in the White House, and allegedly we've heard that President Obama was a little bit unhappy at the coincidence of President Medvedev of Russia's visit and these arrests following close on its heels because relations have been improving between the two countries.
So almost the opposite of what Carol is saying, that this would be not the kind of diplomatic moment in which to roll something like this out?
Well, Russia's foreign minister yesterday, Ivan Lavrov, suggested that there were forces, dark forces within the U.S. government that wanted to undermine the improving relationship. But there's very little evidence of that. Both sides have made high-level statements essentially saying we're not going to worry about this too much and we're not going to let it affect our relations. So if there was such a plot, it seems to have failed.
Javier, why, in the case of Vicky Pelez, if she was spying for Russia, do you think she might have believed that she was working for something better than the U.S., or do you think it was just for the money? I mean, despite her criticisms of the United States, and maybe she's written, pro-Chavez, I don't know, but I got that impression, or pro-Morales in Latin America's context, Russia isn't communist anymore. Russia isn't trying to create an egalitarian utopia. It's just a big capitalist country, but without the inconvenience of much democracy. So what was the cause?
I don't know. Remember that Vicky Peláez and her husband, Juan Lázaro, they became reporters in Latin America during the 1960s. That's after Fidel Castro took the power in Cuba. So they have that kind of skills and mentality. And then the problem is, this is a question a lot of people call me and say, where is the crime? What Vicky Peláez was doing it? And a lot of people start questioning her husband, Juan Lázaro. Why? Because now in the indictment, he's always saying that he's from Uruguay, but now in the indictment, he's suggesting that he is from Russia. And probably he's the one with the connections, and probably he's the one who got the whole thing together. But we don't know if she did it for the money, or they did it for the money, or they didn't do it. We don't know.
Scott, I was joking at the beginning of the segment about things Russian spies are not supposed to do, according to the media coverage. Live normal suburban lives in Montclair. Live swinging singles lives in Manhattan, like that young redhead who the tabloids are having a field day with. Write newspaper columns critical of the United States. Raise children who study classical piano, as Vicky Pelez was also doing, or work as financial planners. In other words, all these things the suspects did, partly to blend in, allegedly are being reported as weird for spies. But isn't that exactly the game? You do blend in?
Well, certainly. I mean, the two big categories of spies are sometimes called legal and illegal, or official cover and unofficial cover. And under official cover, the traditional way this is done is you go to, say, the CIA sends somebody to Moscow as the, third secretary for agriculture. And usually the American spy actually does that job, part of the time. But meanwhile, he's trying to recruit Russians to, give us secrets, and vice versa. But that's official cover, diplomatic cover. And if things go awry and you get caught, meeting a source or something, you get expelled. You don't get charged with a crime because you have diplomatic immunity. These illegals or unofficial cover operators are supposed to play other roles. They're supposed to have nothing to do with the Russian government in this case. They're supposed to be doing exactly what these folks were doing. I think the more puzzling part is presumably you're also supposed to be doing a little spying on the side, and these folks don't seem to have done a whole lot of that.
Yeah, I presume American spies around the world also try to fit in and not try to stick out?
Absolutely, and our linguistic skills usually make that difficult for us. Mm. These folks, a lot of them could speak English with an American accent.
Right, and funny post from Laurie in Montclair. I was shopping in Kings in Upper Montclair yesterday, and it was all abuzz over the Russian spy case. Montclair's mayor and council on the verge of property tax revolt must be very grateful for the distraction. So, Javier, you posted a story to your site, Queens Latino, with the headline, Different Spies. And it's a comparison of how different the lives and the covers were for Vicky Pelez writing for El Diario and for the, you know, the young swinging redhead Anna Chapman who had worked for a hedge fund and things like that. What was your point?
My point is the people start asking why Vicky Pelez is involved in that and why the attention that you mentioned before of the tabloids with this redhead on the cover all the time and nobody's paying attention to Vicky. But in our Latino community, everybody wants to know about what's happened with Vicky. And that's what I decided to put the two pictures together and to portray, because this Anna Chapman is very attractive, a lot of money. She has been working for a lot of important people on the international level, contrary to Vicky Pelez, who travel to Peru often and writes a column and make a few dollars. So it's a very, very uneven spy situation.
All right. We leave it there with Javier Castano from Queens Latino and Scott Shane, national security correspondent for The New York Times. We'll see what else emerges from this story. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, the era of the multiple valedictorians. If you were ever a valedictorian, or we go back to our pool of now vacationing high school teachers, if your school had more than one valedictorian or maybe did away with the title of valedictorian altogether, we want to hear from you. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, because all the children are above average.